It's really great to be back to Wollongong. I went to Year 10 and I went to Wollongong University, and I started off with, four children, and the youngest was one, and I decided that I wanted to go to university because I couldn't see Centrelink as an option, so I'm just introducing you to understand where I come from. So I went and did arts law, and I started it mid-1997, and very interesting, and then I got offered an education degree distance. So I did 3 undergraduate degrees, 4 children, lived in domestic violence and had very little money. And now I'm a solicitor. So that's a really, you know, a big step for me. So I'm certainly happy to be here, and I'm, thank you, happy as a mum to also...
Very strengthful.
Absolutely. And Auntie Barb's been a wonderful person, because I always raided the fridge at the Aboriginal Studies Department, and because I didn't have much money to get home and I didn't get much money for food. So thanks, Auntie Barb. That was really good. And also I think that it's really important to honour not only, as we've said, the waters and the lands and our peoples and our elders, and also that Wollongong University stands on land that's never changed. The law never changes. Our law never changes. So I think that's really important to acknowledge that. And Wollongong is a very special place with very special people. So I've been very thankful for that. I think probably coming from my position, I'll look at different things because, as I said, I'm a solicitor. Before I was a solicitor, I was a very airy-fairy musician. But law makes you sort of look in a different way. It's a logical process. You're passionate, but you still say, well, OK, but how does that work? Or what do I need to find to have some sense of the law that I'm looking at? So it actually skills me in that discipline, and that can be very hard, like Michael said, a foot in both camps, as a lawyer, an Aboriginal person, and an activist as well. So combining those is very difficult. I will say at the beginning that my doctoral thesis, I'm just finishing the last 2 chapters on the revisions, which is 15 chapters, about Aboriginal water rights. And I've written a lot on water rights and how that works. It's really interesting that we have such a complex system, because when we look at water rights, for example, it's not just the water, and I think Michael's talked about that and many people in our community will tell you, it's the water, it's the essence, it's the spirit, it's what we need, it's the birthing rights, it's a whole range of different things. And it's the same as we've talked about natural resources. It's not the oil, it's not the gas, it's not, you know, a uranium ore. It actually means something. There's a creation story that means that exists because. They're not mythical. And I know a lot of the material that I've read over the years, it talks about Aboriginal myths, but everything was created, did happen. Very much like other people's beliefs. So we're dealing with realities of intangible and tangible things in the way we believe. What we don't see exists. Everything has a spirit, the rocks, the trees, everywhere you go. So that's where we start from. It was really interesting when I went to the Garma Festival in the Northern Territory. We had a whole bunch of people from Canada, Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people as well. And we had to come together to write a declaration of rights, water rights, for the Turkey Forum on Water. And it was really interesting because we all agreed that water was sacred, but we had very different ideas on how that should be combined and be written in a language that also honoured us as Aboriginal peoples and how we actually wanted to express our rights. But also we were contained in a framework of international law language. And that's very difficult because we talk about rights, water rights, rights to this, rights to that. Lots of international conventions talk about rights too. Unfortunately, when we came together, it was, well, no, I don't really mean that. So even though we were Indigenous people from all over the world and people representing Australia, we couldn't come together and discuss our rights in a way that we all could really have absolute 100% consensus. And I think that's what Michael's talking about too. Even though we're Aboriginal peoples and we're also Torres Strait Islander peoples in Australia, we don't all have the same views. And that's really important that we respect different views. At the end of it, I didn't support the declaration to go up because I wasn't happy that there was enough of us in it. So I didn't support that declaration in 2008. I was a bit disappointed with being confined within that language, so it didn't help me. I think the most important thing is, as I said, when I studied law in Wollongong, the first small, I guess, area that people talked about was native title. In our studies, when you do law, you do introductory units, and there was only a small amount of what we do or who we are. And I remember that there was laughter when we talked about payback and all of those sort of things. So that was a bit titillating. There wasn't any serious discussion. And I always remember that because, as I said, Stan Jarrett was with me and also Gary Keynes. So we started off and I finished. So I think that that always was a very confronting conversation. As far as sovereignty goes, there's different ways of looking at sovereignty. If, like Michael said, if you look at it legally, on a legal basis, everything that we do, everything that Australia is framed in is a dominant paradigm. In other words, it's the Crown, it's the laws of England, it's a whole combination of things that we have to look at as sovereignty. But sovereignty, for a lot of us too in communities, is a philosophical and also the understanding that we haven't ceded sovereignty. And most people in community, especially in the Kimberley for our Ngingitamungla family, my father-in-law is a senior law person over there, they say, look, this is our law. So even though they respect, you know, they drive on the right side of the road, they wear a seatbelt, all of those things, they oblige. But the law is the law and it doesn't change and it hasn't changed. It's the same, it exists. So many Aboriginal people in communities and remote communities understand that, but when they come before the courts, and because of the alcohol free zones and whatnot up there, they're dealt with under European law, Australian law, and that makes it a very difficult situation. I believe that there should be more discussion about sovereignty because there are more finer points, like Michael said. When we think of what we'd say a prima facie case, if we could go further with what Michael's introduced, I think that's really important to point out that we should pursue those conversations. And the things that I found when I was doing a whole bunch of research for my doctorate is that the most important thing is we're always saying that our sovereignty is like Canada and the US, and it couldn't be further from the truth, because we haven't had that historical beginning. And that's the issue. Our story as Aboriginal peoples is very different, and the way it developed. So we need to understand that difference, and I think we can't generically put us in that category of peoples and our experiences. We've got to look at, like Michael said, how it began and how Australia took possession of... how the British took possession of Australia. I think that's very important. But a lot of those US and Canadian cases talk about fiduciary duty, and that's one aspect that I looked at in my thesis. And it's really an important issue, and it could be a whole thesis on itself. Because that's in law today in Australia, we have different classes of people who we're responsible through that duty of care, through that fiduciary duty. But in a lot of the cases that they have overseas, the state themselves, the US or Canada, have a fiduciary duty to look after Indigenous peoples. In Australia, we don't have that class. And when I talk to fellow colleagues at the bar, they say to me, well, you know, what we'd have to do is have a case that develops fiduciary duty to include Aboriginal people, or we have to have some other way. Because if we did have fiduciary duty, we'd also have to go to the courts like they did over in the US and then claim and the amount of misappropriation of Aboriginal funding, for example, that was used by the government. Sorry, which one?
I can't quite hear the word you use.
Fiduciary duty? Fiduciary duty is when the country itself, or it can be like a doctor-student relationship, where the doctor has to, when you come in, he says, well, you know, how can I help you? There are certain codes that he has to deal with and maintain a responsibility to that person. So that's what fiduciary duty means. And it's a really important concept to look at. Especially when we're talking about sovereignty. So Michael mentioned treaties too, and I always say, with treaties, who are we actually making a treaty with. And this is the difficulty with sovereignty, because we have so many different peoples, and as we've developed in so many different ways, some communities aren't remote communities that still have law. They acknowledge law, but because of people not being initiated and those degrees of laws not being passed through, that's a difficult part on saying who are we going to make treaty with. But it is important to remember that when we make contracts or when we make agreements or collaborative instruments, it's important, like Michael said, the word we use. Treaty is a very strong word, and it also carries a lot of weight when we talk about making sovereignty. So that is certainly important. The only point that I looked at as well is being dependent nations. The thing is, too, with the US, they were acknowledged as self-governing, self-determining. And a lot of material has been written in Australia, and we, in that concept, are not dependent nations, because the British didn't acknowledge us as self-governing. They saw wastelands, they saw uninhabited areas of land. But, however, I've always said that that's a misconception, because the British, the Canadian people always had so much networking and relationship with Indigenous peoples that it was impossible to have come to Australia and said that nobody lives here. And I don't have any consciousness about Indigenous people or people who are Indigenous in Indigenous communities to deal with. They had a long history of dealing with Indigenous peoples, and I see that as quite spurious, unbelievably ridiculous to believe that people would come here and say that they had no relationship or understanding of Aboriginal people. Yeah, so that's one area that I've always had difficulty with. As far as the constitutions go, I think that that's what we need to look at too, because the state and the Commonwealth constitutions in themselves have not acknowledged Aboriginal people till quite well after the constitution. When I went back into the constitutional debates, and they were held in whole different areas and also, you know, on a floating boat, they had luxury when they were debating the constitution. And it was really interesting because, you know, that concept was through very much a wealthy white man's eyes. It was looking at regarding property as allowing people to vote. And it certainly didn't include Indigenous people at that time. So what we come to now is a lot of the constitutions, of course, say that they appropriate resources, they appropriate land, and when we came to native title, that's one area that we've got a whole range of different opinions on. But I know when I watched the program with Keating the other day, the Mabo program, I thought it really was urgent for us to get some legislation, however imperfect. But it was really important also that the law since Mabo, since Keating and other members had passed that in the Houses, that it's changed. Our amendments to native title have changed. And that's why sovereignty seems much more enticing, because native title itself has withdrawn the rights to Aboriginal people. We don't have a veto right. A lot of our communities with the James Price Point, the Jabba Jabba people, and also mining in the Kimberley, people just can't say no to. They just have to take that on board. Within 6 months, if they don't negotiate in good faith, they go and they're told by the courts that mining exploration has to proceed. So there isn't an empowerment. And when we hear of Twiggy Forest and Generation One and all of these other jobs being provided for Aboriginal people, they're entry-level jobs, and they're also jobs that are creating opportunities for a lot of people to destroy country. So it's not viable employment. That's the problem. It's a bit like being hired by an axe murderer. Yeah. Look, all sides of Parliament have to take responsibility for that, because all sides of Parliament changed those native title amendments. So everybody's responsible. The only concerns I have that in that constitutional space that we're talking about in sovereignty is I feel in myself that we've got too short a lead up to really make people understand what we want. I feel that it's too early. Just having that dialogue and conversation with ordinary people in the street about what Aboriginal people want out of sovereignty and want out of constitutional change takes a long time. And all the treaties that I've read in Canada and the US and New Zealand have taken 25, 30 years. So, you know, we want it tomorrow. it's not going to be that easy. And it would be a lovely way to go, but, you know, those sort of... And I guess it's like the old people, you know, and I know when we go to... And we sit down with the old people, like Michael said, they take time. They want to know. They want to listen. I think the constitutional referendum and the whole idea about us having those changes is too early. And I think that we also have to be very careful, being a solicitor, the wording we use, and that we've taken everything in, that we've protected the natural resources. And we're actually reclaiming those natural resources back in part, and the water and the land, and how that's going to interfere with the Aboriginal Land Rights Act. There's a whole range of different things that we have to consider, and we're not considering those because, as Michael mentioned, there's an A-team. And I think that that's the disappointing part, that a lot of us that work very hard behind the scenes and quietly need to contribute to that conversation, because we're actually working quietly in the background and we need to be part of that conversation and that dialogue. Especially as I look in water rights, there's no Aboriginal speakers invited by large summits and governments. And I know that my particular one is the only one in Australia that's writing widely on why our values are important. The other area is, though, I have difficulty with is culture and language and why we actually want to provide sovereignty. When I've worked on Aboriginal site surveys, and Ditch knows, you know, you go up and, you know, you've got to have a look to see if there's any archaeological sites there. Women's sites and men's sites were done by other people. And those laws are not protecting our Aboriginal sites at all. It's so easy for companies to override the Illawarra Land Council or any of us that actually go out and decide that those sites need protection. The developments that have happened are overriding what Aboriginal artefacts there are. And I've worked with a lot of archaeologists who basically have a PhD in Byzantine or Egyptology. They don't have a PhD in Aboriginal issues at all. And that's very disappointing. And also, the whole idea with sovereignty is wrapped up with acknowledging natural resource management. But you have to own the resources to actually have dialogue, you know. You can't just be a person that's talking about it but not incorporated within it. And that's why we think sovereignty is so important, because it's just moving the shift of power. At the moment, we, as Aboriginal people, don't have any power. We don't have veto rights. As when we're on site surveys, we don't have the right to stop a development. Sandon Point, all of those other ones that are really important in this area. And I heard on the radio, Church Street, there's two old houses and they want to make sure that Throsby's remnant history under those houses is preserved. So, you know, it's a ridiculous way to go. Intellectual property. A lot of traditional owners want to research and develop medicines. Now, that's another thing that is really part of this sovereignty argument. There is no model agreement in Australia to assist Aboriginal peoples to negotiate with universities or other contracting parties. So we need to have a model agreement that also protects those rights. When we write PhDs, our rights are lost, because when they're written, we lose the power to control those. When books are written about us, we lose the power to control what's used in that information. So that's always concerned me, and it concerned me when I wrote the thesis. And also because it's Aboriginal knowledge and the source. The most important thing is the testimony from people, not people, archaeologists, anthropologists writing about Aboriginal people. The narrative starts with Aboriginal people, and that's really important. International law is disappointing. I remember studying international law under Peter Bailey and when I did my master's at law in ANU, and I always questioned, I said, but it's not protecting us. Even though we've got international rights, we still have poverty, we have Syria, we have problems in Egypt. You know, there's a whole range of world issues that we have as well as here, but there is no protection. So even though we claim that there's a United Nations Declaration of Indigenous Rights, it's a policy document at the moment. It doesn't allow us to claim anything, and that's hence why we go back to this sovereignty issue, because it's empowering. Those documents aren't taken seriously. So when we're talking about a right to an Article 25 and 26 of the United Nations Rights of Indigenous People, it's not giving us any power to do anything. It's just a policy document. And that's another disappointing thing about it. The economic development, there is very little economic development in Aboriginal Australia because people are being employees, not employers. And I think that's really important. The control, the power needs to be with the communities themselves. There's more opportunities to be employed at an entry level, but there's no seniority. There's no development of acknowledgement of senior people or developing where are young people. I've got four children. You want them to have a job, but you want them to be happy and passionate, and you want it to be a morally sound job. So, and also, like Michael said, you know, you need a combination of having Aboriginal knowledge and concepts and culture, but we also need a Western education to make a difference, because you're still going to need lawyers at the end of the day, and that's important. I think one thing that Michael mentioned too was boundaries. The whole idea that we've got multiple boundaries, and this goes to deal with a whole range of sovereignty issues, is that our boundaries on our nations, we know, but our boundaries have changed because of Aboriginal land councils, a whole range of regional councils, ATSIC. It also misconstrued, it misconceived where we actually belong. And I think that that's also an issue that we have to remember, that those boundaries, when we come to sovereignty issues, really need to be set aside. We need to be all in with this dialogue on sovereignty, and that's a really important point. And having 2% of the population, I remember saying, well, how is 2% of the population going to make a difference and really convince Australian society that we are in need of desperate help to repower Aboriginal communities to make decisions and have responsibility and obligations for those decisions. That's important. We still need to convince the rest of Australia that this is good for them too. Because I remember the apology and I remember the vilification, the hate from some of the communities. And it was really powerful. Cathy Freeman, I was teaching policing down at the academy, and I remember people really saying terrible things. Terrible words about her. You know, that is very deep in the Australian consciousness. So we need to really talk to people seriously about that. And I think that even though when we talk about a lot of other changes in constitutional history and the Marriage Act, we need to be really looking at Indigenous issues first. Because, you know, with all due respect, people who are gay are also a minority in Australia. But I think being the first people's minority, we need to have acknowledgement, and we're not getting that. And we're just one of other minorities, and we need to have that respect. And I think that's really important. I think the Department of Aboriginal Affairs is a good point. I worked in the Aboriginal Affairs Department, and I've worked also very closely with the WA Noongar people. And I think it was really important because most of those departments and most of Indigenous policy in Australia is really written by non-Indigenous people. And I have a big issue with that because when you get to the entry level, it's always, you know, the people who don't get incorporated. If you're in a senior area of Aboriginal education policy or legal policy, you don't see people, Professor so-and-so, being part of a law faculty. You know, they're very few and far between. It's very easy. It's like the Twiggy Forest conception of employment. Entry-level jobs, but you won't see the manager of the mine being an Aboriginal person. So that's another reason why sovereignty is so important, because it's empowering and it's an important thing. It's like when Howard developed his whole argument about home ownership. He suspended the Racial Discrimination Act to tell Aboriginal people that they had to have 40-year and 99-year leases to build infrastructure so they could take part in Australia's wealth. That's got to be the most ridiculous proposition that you wouldn't put to anybody who owns any sizeable company in Australia, that you would lease your land, your assets, and want to give them away. And that's another thing that I also acknowledge in my thesis, as well as the intervention when I was working on income management as a senior legal officer with the Australian Law Reform Commission. I had to convince my boss at the time that it was important to do away with compulsory income management. And I got it through eventually, and it got voluntary, completely voluntary. And that was a reason, and a very hard one reason, to be happy that there was some sort of development. So what I'd say basically in closing is that we don't have control. we need to be empowered, and we need to be empowered to discuss these sovereignty issues. And we also need to be empowered as lawyers to come together and discuss these issues to see if there's any cause of legal action, if there's any ability to take it to a court. But we also need, before we do that, we need to really talk with the Australian people. We need to talk with society so they understand what we want and why our lives aren't that great, and why if we just receive royalties, that's not sufficient. We actually have to have ownership in the natural resources. We have to have ownership in water. We have to have ownership in the land, because even the old people, as far up as the northern area of Australia, they talk about succession. There are plans put in place by communities when the last person of that community passes away, that a neighbouring land will take over and look after that land. They don't speak with full authority for that land, but they take care of that land. And what we need to do is have succession planning built into this sovereignty issue so we can pass on to the kids, so they can be strong and know that they don't have to go and take a mortgage out to get their land. Their land is going to be given back that was once stolen. Thank you.
I think we have space for two or three questions if you want to. If there are any questions, otherwise we can continue over the coffee, continue the conversation there. So Fred and then Elsa.
In 1939,
you asked for an inquiry into the war issue in Australia. Yeah, I didn't get a copy of that. Rudy Maxwell rang me up and she said, I've been trying to find you, you're doing a thesis or whatever. And what I want to do is, what I said to her was, I want to have an inquiry into just Aboriginal water rights. Because every time you look at water rights, the Murray-Darling Basin, for example, where are Aboriginal people's desires represented?
Precisely.
They're not. Where's the discussion about ownership in those water rights discussed? They're not. I've been through a lot of the Senate inquiries. Tony Windsor did a big one, a big inquiry into the Murray-Darling Basin. And there are many other people who have done it as well, but they don't talk specifically about Aboriginal people. It's two pages. It's half a page in a report, a technical report. So what I was saying is we just need an inquiry on that alone, so people from all around Australia can come and say, look, water's important to us. This is what we mean by water, water values, ownership. I think we need to have that discussion. We've never had that in Australia, ever. Sorry.
I'll keep it for later. Okay. Workshop.
You were saying that you finished your thesis?
Yeah, I'm revising the last two chapters. There's 15 chapters on water. Yeah.
All right, because if it's the only resource of its kind
it
that discusses Indigenous relationships with water, it'd be really nice to know when it will become available.
Yeah. Well, that's what my husband keeps on saying. Yeah, well, it's Macquarie University. You can keep tabs on me there. That's where I've done my PhD. And I will be publishing it. And it's really important that this comes out because I saw a recent book that was in the Law Society Journal and reviewed. It had a half a page on Aboriginal people in the whole textbook. That's a recent one. And every book talks about, this is, goes back to your question, half a page, one page. Surely after thousands of years, we've got more than one page, you know. So that's why it's a dedication. And hopefully a lot of other academic research and Aboriginal peoples being involved in this, doing research themselves, not people researching about our things, that Aboriginal people are researching these issues. I think that's what I'd like to see. Most people write about us. We don't write about ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I ask you, can I ask you to come back? We can have a break now. And can I ask you to come back at 20 past 11 so that we try to keep roughly on time and we've got more time for the workshops and the round tables in the afternoon? And before we go, can I actually invite you to thank the two speakers for launching the event and launching the discussion today?
Thank you.
actually, the two actually.